profile, particularly for the type 2 plateaus. The type 1As, which were discussed by Wolfgang and Tyrone before, show no hydrogen, but characterized by a strong silicon 2 feature. The type 1Bs don't show the silicon 2 feature, but show helium lines instead. The type 1Cs do not show the helium features. And the type 2Bs are sort of a hybrid between the 2s and the 1Bs. They show helium lines, but also the presence of some hydrogen. Okay, so this is another way of looking at this in terms of this chart laid out. So here are the various hydrogen-rich and hydrogen-poor supernovae. The hydrogen-rich type 2s are classically broken down by light curve type between 2Ls and 2Ps, which may show some spectroscopic differences as well. And for recent work, it's not clear whether that light curve division actually really exists. I also include here the type 2Ns, which are these supernovae that show circumstellar interaction throughout much of their history. And the key, in a very simplistic way, to thinking about how these types come about the core cloud supernovae is in terms of the degree of envelope stripping of the progenitor. Okay, and then, of course, there's differences in the light curves between various supernova types. And the first order, the amount of nickel mass which drives this exponential decay depends on the mass of the particular core. Okay, so you've already seen sort of a version of this slide, I think, in Wolfgang's talk. And I won't spend a fair amount of time talking about the general models for type 1As. But the key is we have those various types of supernovae, and we want to map those into models for their progenitors. So it's thought, at least canonically, that the type 2Ps, maybe the 2Ls and the 2Ns, come from single massive supergiant stars. Maybe they're not quite so single, maybe they're in binary systems, but the degree of interaction with their game is not particularly severe. And then there are the so-called stripped envelope supernovae. Again, the degree of envelope stripping sort of defines this class. So the 2Ds, 1Ds, and 1Cs. So as Wolfgang pointed out, maybe they come from a single Wolf Rayet type star that's prodigiously losing mass, or through an interacting binary system that's moving the mass. Okay, let me remind you about your massive star evolution. So we expect stars in this mass range to end their lives as red supergiant stars. And so in this flavor of evolutionary tracks from recent times, as you go up the main sequence mass, the star does not spend as much time in red, but actually heads over towards the blue. And for the most massive stars, they spend most of their lifetime in the blue. And then things get even more complicated if you include binary evolution. So there are various binary models generated by Jim Eldridge. And so you can get blue progenitors from binary evolution. You can also get some yellow progenitors as well. Okay, and we expect a lot of massive stars to be in binary systems, in fact, interactive binary systems. So there are now several studies, and this is the main one that showed that on the order of about 70% of stars greater than 15 solar masses are in some sort of interacting binary system. So the odds are against massive stars dying by themselves. Okay, what do the explosion models say about supernova progenitors? So this is a recent work, very nice paper. I certainly recommend all of you to take a look at it. Where these are 1D calculations that were calibrated with 3D calibrations. But what they find here, and apologies to those of you who are colorblind, I did not make this slide, but let me help you through this. The orange and green things here are stars that will eject their massive explosion leaving behind a neutron star. and the things that are yellow and black will collapse down into black holes. And then the gray part represents the masses lost or the history of the progenitor. And so they talk about, this is their words, islands of explodability in a sea of black hole formation. Okay, so observationally, how do we constrain the nature of the supernova progenitors? And so there are a variety of different ways. You can do it through hydrodynamical simulations of the supernovae themselves, the light curves of their spectra. You can constrain them based on the stellar and gaseous environment that the supernova occurs in, sort of age dating the population. You can wait until later times and get nebular spectroscopy and model the elements that you see from nuclear synthesis and the explosion. And then the thing that the way I like to do this is through direct identification. Okay, so this is easy. Okay, this is very straightforward. This is just pure astronomy. You have a high resolution pre-explosion image. Either take from a very good telescope from the ground for nearby galaxies or for more distant galaxies out to say about 20 megaparsecs or so, data in the HST archive. And so you have, you take a similar high quality image of the explosion itself. HST is preferred, but you can do this with AO imaging to match the HST resolution. And so there's your explosion and there's your progenitor star. Okay, so the magic is all in how you interpret the properties of that detected point source. Okay, so do we see red supergiants as progenitors of type 2 supernovae as the evolutionary models predict? Well, oops, of course, you know, the best possible case for progenitor identification is for 87A. I'm sure we'll hear more about 87A. Itself, but we might know more about the progenitor. So I just want to mention, of course, we know we have a spectra of this star, so we know it was a mean supergiant. And we're probably never going to, at least in my lifetime, ever have a better or comparable example of progenitor identification. Okay, yes, so the next best case is 2008 BK in a nearby galaxy. 3 megaparsecs, and so there we found in high quality ground-based images the red supergiant, and we know it was a progenitor because more recent images shows that the star is gone. There's its little friend next door, and so here's the ground-based seeing this basically, and so we know there are a number of major stars that were within that seeing this. So the photometry we extract for that star in the ground-based images needs to be corrected for all of the points. Individual stars, and then there's a nice little light echo around the supernova. And I'm going to gloss over all of the stellar astrophysics detail here because you will definitely go to sleep. If you're really interested, I can show you offline how we get to this point. But you basically develop a spectral energy distribution for the progenitor based on the available photometry that you have. And you try to fit a stellar model, and so in this case we fit a 3,500 degree red supergiant atmosphere with very little interstellar reddening, both in the galaxy and in the host galaxy itself. And doing that, we get a luminosity and a temperature assuming the bolometric correction, and we can put that star on an HR diagram and fit it with a variety of different evolutionary tracks. And I would argue, at least, that this star was about 8 or 9 solar masses on the zero-H-8 sequence. However, I encourage you to look at Justin Mond's paper. Justin's here at the meeting. He gets a slightly larger mass, significantly larger mass. There was a talk earlier, I think it was Roger's talk, where the discussion was the correct progenitor about 8 or 9 solar masses. And so here's a possible analog, except that it probably didn't get nearly as bright as the correct supernova did. It's a low energy, a subluminous type 2 P supernova. So not all of the supernovae are of low energy. There are certainly normal luminosity type 2Ps. It's just a harder to get their progenitors. Kind of sort of multiple bias. But anyway, here's 12AW, and there is the red supergiant that Morgan Frazier and his collaborators and myself identified in HST images. Again, skipping all the details, you can get a luminosity and an effective temperature and put it on the HR diagram. And again, there's some recent stellar evolutionary tracks that might indicate that the progenitor was on the order of 15 solar masses on the Zipwhite Chain sequence. All right, so you know, maybe there are differences between type 2L supernovae and type 15, maybe they're not. There are certainly recent papers that indicate this, that this example, 13EJ in N74, indices 628, had properties that made it unusual relative to the 12AW in particular, other normal type 2 plateaus. And so there's the progenitor. Sorry, there should be a reference there to Morgan Frazier's paper. He discovered the progenitor. Apologies. But you see this little asterism of red supergiants here, and there's the one red supergiant that actually had a little had a B star sort of within the same, or you know, B star within the same PSF. So probably not necessarily a companion, but you know, things can be crowded in a massive star forming region that you know, 10 megaparsecs. So it made the blue bands unusable really for characterizing the spectral energy distribution of those progenitors. So we really only had I band and then a K band image from the ground. And with that, with those two points, fitting an SCE and getting out a T effective in an L bowl, you could actually put it on an HR diagram. And again, comparison with recent tracks points to something on the order of 17 solar masses, which is dangerously up towards the limit of what we're telling people in the community is sort of the outside of where type 2 supernovae come from. In particular, is a smart limit, but you know, again, there's probably a little paramount uncertainty in this number. Okay, so what about the strip down below supernovae? All right, well, so in the case of the 2Bs, where you've got some hydrogen, mostly helium lines showing up, there's the progenitor, again, in HST images, Justin group and my group found it. At the same time, and there's the SED, and look, it's much, much warmer than what we would typically expect for a red supergiant. Even though the star itself is quite big, but it's only a tenth of a less than a tenth of the solar mass of hydrogen, so the star is really puffed up with a around the helium core of about 3 to 5 solar masses. And so Lane Burstyn and her collaborators model the light curve for this particular type 2B, 11DH, and 51. And we're able to do that in terms of a binary model, binary interacting model. So here is the locus of this star on the HR diagram. And so they say that the binary had about 4 solar masses of explosion, and there should be a companion, a hot companion, of about 16 solar masses to be detected. Okay, and we've been struggling for years to get a progenitor identification for a type 1B. Now, this has really been a struggle. And Cal et al. Found this object for as the progenitor candidate for this IPTF13BDN. Seems to be pretty normalish 1B. And there was a lot of initial analysis on this. Well, maybe it was a Wolf-Rayet star that exploded. Turns out the photometry they got from the HST images was a little too faint. So we actually redo the photometry and the objects a little brighter. So it probably is more in line with the evolution of the interacting binary system. So this is Eldridge et al. Did a family of BPAS models to sort of explain where the progenitor could be on the HR diagram. And similar conclusions were made by persons in front of me. Okay, so now we know because that star, that object is now faded. It's faded significantly. Unfortunately, it hasn't faded quite enough. Justin Mon and J.J. Eldridge had a similar paper where both concluded basically that the supernova is still contributing to the light. But we considered two different scenarios that either the supernova is contributing to the light still, or what we're seeing at late times, which is just another result, part of the environment, the overall environment of the supernova. Probably the truth is somewhere in between these two scenarios, but we compared this scenario to a variety of binary models, Wolf-Rayet models, and so here John Eldridge's BPAS models as well. So we actually hope to go back with HST this next cycle, or some cycle before there are a couple more cycles, and take another look and try to get nailed down what the properties of the IGTF 13 progenitor were. Okay, the type 1C progenitors, though, continue to illuminance. This is mostly driven by the fact, it's driven by the fact that we expect them to be hot, so there's not a lot of UV data in the HST archive. That's generally a problem. But then what makes it worse is that the type 1C supernovae tend to occur in relatively crowded environments, near star clusters, et cetera, which is consistent with our thought that they come from very massive stars. And those environments tend to be quite dusty. Here's a case where the reddening to the supernova is quite high. So this is that whole conspiracy of events has made it difficult for us to get anything but upper limits on type 1C progenitors. Okay, and finally I mentioned the two N's. So you almost certainly heard the fact that people talking about the 2N LVV connection. And there's a lot of evidence pointing in that direction, but the only direct evidence that we have is thin, in my opinion, is based on the identification of the progenitor of this supernova by TL, which actually wasn't a very typical 2N. It only had a sort of circumstellar interaction for a short period of time and became more mobile later. But what Galliano said is, you look at the position of the supernova, and there's an object that was in minus 10 absolute magnitude, which is consistent with something that you would expect for an LVV interruption. And then they went back 10 years later, and that thing is gone. So it's very compelling, but again, this is at 66 megaparsecs. This is the most distant progenitor identification we've ever made. And a single 1.2 pixel is 32 parsecs, or even a tenth of a pixel is about 3 parsecs. And a lot of action goes on in a few parsecs in a galaxy where you're expecting a lot of massive stars. Okay, so today, today we have these detections nominally placed a few from the ground, but most are identified with HST. We've been developing some statistics, but I still claim it's really still early in this game. And Justin has contributed strongly to coming back later and taking a look and determining whether the progenitors have disappeared or whether they actually were progenitors. So there's several cases where you see a cross through the supernova's name, so that's basically saying that wasn't a progenitor identification after all. And in the case of the progenitor of this 2P, we identified a yellow supergiant, but then when Justin goes back later, he sees that there's a little blue star there, so it's probably a blue star plus a red star, which means yellow, right? This is probably just a red supergiant after all. And then, of course, a number of upper limits, and I can't underestimate the amount of time that's been put into generating just these upper limits. Okay, so before the confirmation, basically, of IGTF13PBN's progenitor, it was, what was us? We're not able to get the progenitors for strict envelope supernovae, particularly 1Bs and one sees. What do we do now? You know, it's so hard. So what can we do next? And so these authors basically suggested, well, instead of looking for the progenitor, maybe go back later time. You know, they come from interactive binary systems, look for the binary companion. Okay, well, to do that search, the supernova has to be old enough that it's capable of detectability. If you're going to do this search, you're looking for something hot. You definitely want it to have faded enough in the UV where, you know, unambiguously seeing something other than a supernova. It would really help if it was clearly detected in previous high-resolution imaging, so you can basically just do the simple astrometry to see what you're looking at. And it shouldn't experience low redding. Again, you're trying to look in the UV for this companion. It's going to need a lot of redding. It probably should have occurred in a relatively uncrowded field, so there's not a lot of confusion with sources in the environment. And it should be in a fairly nearby host galaxy, so you know, get as many photons as you can, and relatively low inclination again to mitigate against confusion. That makes for a really short list of possible targets. Okay, so now I'll talk about some of these targets. Okay. So, one of those objects is 1993J, and Wolfgang alluded to this. Again, I point out that 93J was used as a template to match to CASA's spectrospectrum. So, you know, we have some confidence that CASA came from a supernova very similar to 1993J, from a 2B. Okay, so that's why this is kind of relevant. And again, the discussion about where's the companion of CASA. So Justin Mon took spectrum around 2004, so the supernova was about 10 years old, but it's still relatively bright. And what he noticed in the spectrum, particularly the blue, were these absorption lines, which were perfectly consistent with there being a B supergiant within the PSF, basically, of the supernova. Okay, and so we've gone back much more recently with C3 and caused in the UV, and so here's what the field looks like. So the supernova has faded greatly, so here's the toss aperture, and you can see there are a number of UV bright objects within the toss aperture, including the supernova itself. And I also point out this curious thing that the supernova PSF is actually a little elongated. But anyway, so we get nowhere near the signal and noise that Justin got. It's kind of a noisy spectrum. We still see a signature of an old supernova there, but we also see the combined spectra of several of these bright stars, plus the presence of what looks like a B2 supergiant in that overall PSF. Okay, so maybe that's the companion. We're going to continue to follow that up. Okay, following in that thread, then we have this 2B 2011 DH M51. And we went back in the UV when it was 3 years old or so. And there's a bright UV object right at the position of the supernova. So we interpreted that in terms of Melina Burstyn's binary interaction model. And it's pretty much in line with, you know, a fair amount of mass transfer, not a lot. But it's consistent with the model. However, Justin has recently come back and said, well, wait, not so fast. If you look at the redder bands, it's clear that the supernova is still there. You know, so how much of that UV light we're seeing in this image is not just from the supernova or this combination of supernova plus whatever companion that might be there. So it's probably incumbent on us to wait a little longer and come back and take a look again. Okay, so I wrote a recent paper with Selma DeMake and her student Monica Zapartis on search for the companion to the type 1C progenitor of the type 1C supernova 1994 object. So again, it's an N51, so fairly nearby. This, by the way, is a very recent unpublished TRGB distance to N51. Really handy for N51. You know, in this galaxy, a lot of the study. So anyway, there's the supernova in 1994, but nothing is detected at the position of the supernova 20 years later in UV. Okay, so we tried to model this upper limit. We expect, from some of those models, we expect if the companion's there, it must have main sequence-like properties. So we use various main sequence stars. We didn't have the TRGB distance, so we assumed sort of the range of possible distances, N51, the range of possible breadthings, a lot of range. But basically, we came to the conclusion that a star hotter than about B2 should have been detected. And therefore, the companion mass must be less than about 10 solar masses for this pipeline scene. Okay, so Selma and Manos worked a bunch of magic with their binary population synthesis models. They're not able to actually distinguish between a helium-rich 1B and a helium-poor 1C, but they had something sort of 1BC-like in their models. They found about 99% of the systems had to be main sequence-like, which stands in contrast to previous models for 94i, which said it could have possibly been a neutron star normal star binary or a white dwarf normal star binary. So the most likely scenario that we get for this system based on this upper limit is that the companion mass is somewhere in the order of about 5 or 12 solar masses in a binary system where the mass ratio Q is pretty appreciable. They're similar in mass, and sort of shortish period binary to a fairly longish period binary. And the progenitor, again, was assumed to be about 2.5 solar mass star. Okay, so taking this forward, what do we do next? Well, we're kind of, we're either finding things that we're not sure of, or we're coming up with goose eggs. So we have a program in this HSP cycle, or a box as a PI, to go back and do deep UV imaging. Again, it's a very short list of possible targets to look for potential predator companion. So, we looked at O2AP, which is a hypernova, as it was called. So it's probably a broadline 1C. It was a broadline 1C. And we find nothing. And we just got the data for 10BR, another possible 1B, possible 1C, and a nearby galaxy. We haven't really fully analyzed those data, but it's clear there's nothing in those images. However, we looked at this type 2B, again, we had 11DH and 93J. And O1IG is a similar sort of beast. And we see a UV bright object at the position of O1IG. This is, you know, really preliminary, and all I'm telling you is giving you binary, you know, up or down. So we have to analyze that in terms of stellar models, et cetera, to place these limits in some context, very similar to what some of the ones were able to do for 94i. Okay, and I'd be remiss, we already had a lot of discussion about 1As and their systems, but I should point out, of course, that there has been an attempt to constrain, if these are single degenerate systems leading to type 1As, to constrain the nature of the companion. The deepest possible limit is for 2011 FE, which is a branch normal type 1A in nearby galaxy M101. This is worked by Wei-Yong Lee from pre-supernova HSP images and this group were able to basically eliminate any red giant companion. And in fact, any star with a mass greater than about 3.5 solar masses, which basically eliminates any kind of RS or UP-like systems or T44 systems or B445 hub systems. So that's a fair number of the progenitors that have been put forward to explain type 1As. Okay, this is going to be hard to meet too. We're really going to need something closer. with similar high-quality data. Okay, I think that's my summary. Type 2 PEDs, almost certainly now come from hereditary events. We're pretty confident of that. Type 2 L's may come from more massive hereditary events, but it's really just a case of one or two objects. So I don't know statistics yet. Several type 2 B's look like they come from yellow supergiants. Are those yellow supergiants the result of binary interaction? Unclear. What about this helium star progenitor that was identified for IPTF 13 BBN? Remains to be further confirmed. No detections of type 1C progenitor. And do type 2 N's come from LBBs? Again, I will claim that is hinging on until we determine the nature of a couple other objects, which are still being debated, that connection is from a direct standpoint, is hinging on one bit. And so are there hot companions detected so far for 2Bs? Again, I think there's more time and analysis is necessary. No companion detected for the 1-1C that we looked at, and no companion for 11FE. And I just wanted to point out, so many of you knew Kurt Weiler. So he passed away in April from a long bout of cancer. Many of you remember, many of you think of him in terms of his work on radio emission from SuperLV, but I believe his first love was SuperLV remnants. His personalized license plate on his car was 3C58, so I think that pretty much indicates that those were in his blood. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Thanks, Dennis.
So for 2011, I'd be.
So your mic's on. I can probably hear you.
So you mentioned that there was no pre-image companions for 2011FE.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if you're aware of the work by McCulley et al. 2014 that found pre-HST imaging of a blue supergiant for supernova 1AX 2012C.
Right. So that's a 1AX, which is a class of unusual 1AX. There's a lot of discussion of what 1AXs may be and what their progenitors may be, and it's very tempting to associate 1AXs with potentially hot blue things that might be massive. And I know that the McCulley and his partners, they have a HST program, in fact, to come back and confirm whether that blue thing has disappeared. So we'll see. But the 1AX is not the same as the branch normal 1A. So they're really weird things. Yeah. I think I hear it right.
Okay. Yeah. So I know they said this is original work, and I know we always say that it's practical prediction. But I guess some of your answers, first of all, it depends on standard evolution, like the HR diagram and the evolutionary blocks and stuff and all, you have to match up. So there's some discrepancy in that, right?
Sure.
By the progenitors. And I don't know how much there is in that. For us, also, is there evidence that other wavelengths, like I know hydrodynamic models sometimes fail to produce the same progenitors. They always seem to be getting larger mass progenitors. They explosion models and like for many of these same supernovae.
Yeah.
So is there other kinds of evidence that can work these same masses?
So my general impression is that so I listed way back when the beginning, the various ways people constrain progenitor masses, and my general impression is it's sort of within the ballpark, but there's some disagreement here and there, certainly between the hydrodynamic calculations. Although those are coming more in line with what the direct progenitor IEs are getting. The nebular spectroscopy is a recent paper on 13EJ, where there's a much lower mass that was derived from the oxygen than what I put up in that slide. So that's a discrepancy. The environment, the environmental work, so the work of Julianne Delcanis group did a recent paper on that. You look at that, yeah, maybe they agree here, yeah, that's wildly off, you know, et cetera. So each one of these methods is a way to constrain what the possible gender properties are. I'm not saying that the direct identification of part of the way, for me, they're the most fun way.
What is the real observability among you?
Okay, so I don't have a number for you there. That's something that should be done, this is sort of right, right in comparison between various models, the various constraints. Does that sort of answer your question? Okay, we can talk about that.
Actually, I have questions. One is that we are speaking, this now we're worried about such a large number of representatives for the most part. Is there any case, a single case in which you may have a more gain of quality of the representatives if there is some kind of liability?
Yeah.
Second question is since from the rain, in some cases, that is a very strong wind in the years before that explode. Could you expect that there were some strong, some clusters, you know, and you miss the areas of the brain because of some sort of stealth extinction?
Yeah. Yeah, so let me answer your second question first. So yes, it's certainly possible. There was an object called 2008S, which was probably not a supernova, but it's something that was known as an intermediate luminosity-optical transit, which was completely self-cloaked, and was only detectable at Spitzer. My understanding so far is we haven't, for normal supernovae, we haven't run into that problem yet. The problem is that Spitzer is not very sensitive, so it doesn't give you a lot of information about, usually all you get are other limits of the detection. So if something were in a galaxy 10 megaparsecs with self-cloaked with dust, you would really not be able to do much damage with Spitzer. Unfortunately, we don't, until W first flies, it's not going to go into the thermal infrared. We don't really have anything with kind of resolution that goes into the infrared. And if JW is just going to get a little close. Postal stamps. Your first question was variability, right? So if the host galaxy happened to be one that was studied for Cepheid variability, or, to discover Cepheid by a key project, that's great, because then we actually do have multi-epoch V-band, Q-epoch, Y-band, and problem is oftentimes these progenitors are not waltingly bright, so you're sort of in the noise even with the variability. Chris Channing and company have a paper on 11VH, his progenitor, which they monitor F51 from the LBT, and they actually saw that the star may have been, if I remember correctly, not long before exploding from there. Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Again, with W first, we may be able to do a lot more in the future with that sort of question.
Okay, I think we're going to move on. Thank you very much, sir.